From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Joey asks Aaron about mystery in modern times, and Aaron asks Joey about the allure of teen soap operas.
Woo!
Oh, hello.
Oh, hi.
In case you're wondering, this is still what a Joey sounds like.
The mellifluous, dulcet sounds of an Aaron are what's coming through on this end.
Dulcet. And this is what an executive producer and pumpkin spice activist, Jess Vander, sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess.
So, Aaron.
So, Joey.
I got something for you.
I'm so excited.
It's Angela Lansbury. I just want to talk about her for...
Is she bringing bed knobs or broomsticks? I need one or the other, not both.
She wrote a murder. So I've been thinking about this recently, this idea of mystery, because with everything that's going on, like around the election, and nothing specific around politics or anything like that, but you know, everything is documented now, and we have evidence around anything that anyone ever says, and proof of someone's entire life, their entire campaign, everything they've said in any stump speech at a restaurant, to their kids, to their mother, to their rabbi, to their priest, whatever it is. And I'm wondering what the role of mystery is anymore in a culture where we want to know everything. So... I'm going to go to a nerdy place, and then we can go to a fun place. How's that sound?
Take me with you. I'm excited. I'm excited.
Have you ever heard of the Observer Principle?
No, but I have heard the wolf cry to the blue corn mood. Please tell me.
Yes, the Observer Principle of Pocahontas. the Observer Principle is this idea in quantum physics where... a particle exists in multiple places at once, a waveform, until someone observes it, whether that's, you know, just a detection device or an actual person looking at that particle. And when it's observed, it falls into a particle form where it's in one specific place. The reason I bring this up is I've been thinking about what that means for people and culture and how we sort of collapse people into something specific when you know everything you could possibly know about them. Like, you know where they went to school, what they dress for on Halloween, what their opinion on Pocahontas is, like all of these different things. Like you sort of remove the ability for mystery around people and for them to be multiple things to multiple people and exist in multiple places at once, because we're observing everything about everyone and everything all the time. Like, cameras are constantly running. Like, you're collapsing everything to be one thing now. And I feel like there's something kind of magical about not knowing.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to something like Tinder and all of that, where dating in the olden days, you have to walk up to somebody in real life, ask them questions, and then ask more questions, because you can't learn everything beforehand.
Yeah.
But today, you can find out where they went to school, who their best friends were, who you have in common. You can meet just via the fact that you're in common through digital tech. But the fact that all that information is logged presents other problems too, because even though you can sort of unshroud or deshroud that mystery if you can find out all the information, you still have to search for all of it. And that has to be logged, and it has to be maintained somewhere. And somebody has control over what data is stored where and how up to date it's kept. So we're even losing the ability to control like what it is that we want to present to the world anyway, making that lack of mystery even a little bit more confounding to me.
Yeah, there is... You know, we live, and I personally, as just a sort of nerdy person, like a world that is very scientifically oriented, or at least in many circles, is very scientifically oriented. And science is about collecting data, observing issues, and understanding how things work. At the same time, there is something to be said about not knowing and hoping or orienting towards, you know, magic, for lack of a better term, of, you know, especially when it comes to people. Like, I'm thinking about what it takes for us to hire someone, or what it takes for you, people to go on dates, like you were talking about Tinder, right? Like, you, or to make a decision, right? Like, what's the data? Like, I need to know all of the data. And the idea of like needing to know all the data about every single decision, especially when it comes to sort of social or interpersonal relationships and interactions, feels stiff.
I love hearing you say that in particular, because you're a scientist, and because what always drew me to science when I was a kid, I went through wanting to be an archaeologist, a paleontologist, a chemist. I like basically every different type of ist that I could think of was a career that I wanted to have. And then I got to strategist. But I always was mesmerized by this marriage between reason and magic, right? Like, you can take things that are knowable and concrete and irrefutable, but still find ways to combine them and reorient them, reorganize them, that make the world an amazing place.
Right.
And the question in between reason and magic is that mystery that like, ooh, what could unfold? And it sucks that we're in a really weird place where we're trying to live in one space or the other. We're no longer culturally trying to live happily in between.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something interesting too, because right, talking about science, like when you're measuring sort of small interactions between chemicals or, you know, organisms, or under certain conditions, like you can observe and be like, this thing happened. When we're talking about like the complexity of situations of running a company or finding someone that you're in love with, the data that we have is not going to be conclusive, right?
Like, yeah.
But we're treating that data as though it is. And so what I think happens is you sort of eliminate possibilities that aren't necessarily actually eliminated, right? Where you start to put someone in a bucket or define them and say, you are like this, or you are like that, because you've seen their Twitter feed or Tinder profile or LinkedIn page or whatever it is, that there's sort of a perception that you understand something, or that you have the data that proves a thing out. And maybe like that's not all wrong. Like, there are sort of inclinations, but it sort of eliminates the ability to grow and to change and to be defined in a moment in the past, as opposed to being able to be something in the future. And I just feel like that room for possibility is sort of narrowing our imagination.
Oh, we all need to be. So as a kid, used to go to, you all remember it. It was a store in the mall for kids, Imaginarium, I want to say.
I don't know this, but I know a store like Imaginarium.
Yes. Yeah. And there are so many things that, especially in the 90s, were geared toward like literally blending science and magic for kids and sort of stoking that awe about what the world looks like. I grew up not too far away from COSI, the Columbus, Ohio Science Institute, which was basically, you know, one of the first kids science museums, and one of the best, maybe not one of the first, but that place instilled in me an expectation that the world is a surprising and mysterious place. And so when I put that in contrast to today, where we again just have all of this information and think that every piece of data that we have is concrete, knowable, and that, you know, great, that's that, it does make me feel like we're no longer interested in the exciting, the impossible, or the unlikely, and in challenging those things.
Yeah, I think like that idea of thinking that you know something when you don't necessarily eliminates the mystery, right? Like, you don't know how everyone or everything is going to react in every circumstance, but because we're sort of data oriented, or we know like enough about science, or we have a strong enough belief in ourselves, you start to eliminate it. But what I think is interesting is, you know, so much of the internet broadcast culture, the sort of the data capture that we're talking about, that your camera's always running, that your mic is always running, that you're kind of taking pictures and videos and all of that, collapses reality into proof that this event happened. We're now coming into a time where you're starting to see the things like deep fakes, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, this program that Adobe's working on that can, you know, produce a pretty difficult to discern fake version of someone speaking or saying something, so you can start to put words in people's mouths or put them in situations that they weren't actually in. There's something, you know, it's terrifying. First of all, let's just say that's terrifying. But there is something interesting about it in the ability to sort of eliminate a lot of the data that we would think is real, right? Like things that we see, all of a sudden you have to take a second guess at, and, mm-hmm. and it forces you to be critical of something that you would otherwise not be critical of, right? If you see a video, you're like, that's a video, this person is doing this thing, you're not second guessing it. And all of a sudden now with something like that, you have to start reevaluating. And there could be an interesting outcome of that where, you know, there's a reinfusion of mystery because people are forced to evaluate everything more critically.
Yeah. I mean, one question is whether it is the reinfusion of mystery itself or if it is actually the emotional connections to mystery are different.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of mystery, the way that I even was talking about it with Imaginarium, really need to confirm that that is indeed the name of the store, is mystery as a positive, mystery as,
yeah,
you know, uplifting. But then there are so many other things that, like, bottom line is that mystery is not inherently, like, you know, connected to great emotions.
Yeah.
And those deepfakes unveil the sort of sentiment of, yeah, mystery can be there, but it can just be insidious and terrifying and really overwhelming.
Can I, you have something, Jess?
2 points. One, yes, Imaginarium is real, or at least an Imaginarium. I don't know if it's exactly the one that you're talking about.
But
one exists in Rochester, New York. But a second thing, which is that, I don't know, it sounds like mystery in the way that we're talking about it is something to be lost, you know, something that we're giving up and that is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But what are, I don't know, I have to think that there's something positive about this too, right? Like what's the upside about either losing mystery or what new mystery exists now that didn't before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, though there is, as you were talking and we're going through this, I'm thinking about sort of cultural flow and what we've become interested in. I think we've become hyper focused on reality, mm-hmm. like in quotes, maybe even, yeah. right? But like reality TV, reality, you know, focus on like what other people are doing. Like we're spending so much of our time understanding or attempting to understand the world in the present right now and where it is and what it's like and what the texture of it is and all of that. Is the focus on reality sort of instead of what is possible, like what are the mysteries or what is the unknown? Is that part of the shift that is problematic? You know, I don't know what we get as a result of losing mystery. Like there is sort of this pursuit of knowledge to your point, right? Like if you're pursuing knowledge, then mystery maybe it is something that is worthy to give up.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's like the quenching or the feeling that you can quench the desire, like the thirst for clarity, like that you can actually, by having that mystery solved, like everything is clearer. And perhaps that is what strikes me as the most troubling, because on one hand you get this sort of clarity that can be rooted in hard fact, clear data, and sort of, it's like, oh, it's almost like a sigh of relief over, yes, this is mm-hmm. philosophy solved. But then on the other hand, there's the power of belief mm-hmm. and where things aren't true, where things are just conviction based, mm-hmm. but just as persuasive, those carry just as equal weight as the other actual truths.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things can't be compatible. And perhaps that's what is sort of like falling out of mm-hmm. this lack of mystery or this evolution of mystery. Yeah. Is these two worlds colliding against each other?
Yeah, there's this idea of when we're sort of searching for knowledge and searching to get rid of the ambiguity, what that mystery sort of creates. we're looking for data, right? And the question sort of becomes as well, like, are we looking only at a small or maybe inaccurate data set, mm-hmm. right? Like, we're mm-hmm. only using certain types of data to form these opinions, and maybe that's as much the issue, right? When, you know, like in an interpersonal relationship, there's so much more to be gleaned from having an interaction with a person, and texture and nuance, versus what you're going to find on, a social media feed, for example.
Yes.
There's this organization that is doing legitimate science, but I think they're sort of pursuing mystery in a certain sense. So it's called, I believe it's called the HeartMath Institute. Mm. And what they're looking at is, you know, we've been focused on the brain. You know, I went to school for neuroscience. I spent a lot of time focusing on the brain. But as a culture for a long time, you know, the past 100 years plus, we've been saying, like, you know, at some point we went from like the gut or the heart being sort of the center of your thinking to your brain. We figured out that like a lot of stuff is going on up there. This group is a group of scientists who are looking at like how much data, how much input is happening in some of your peripheral nervous system where you're able to make decisions and glean data. And they're doing all of this science that seems like out there science, but they're taking a really traditional scientific approach to say, like, your heart is sensitive to other things going on in the environment around it. Your gut is sensitive to those things. And if we're only looking at sort of observational data through our eyes and through our brain, you're not getting that full set that you get in person, being around someone, sort of that undescribable energy that you feel in an interaction, of whether that makes you feel good or whether that feels bad or there's something incompatible. And so maybe the mystery is, you know, not about whether we're looking at data, but whether or not we're leaving ourselves open to things that we're not even considering before.
Bottom line is, to Disneyfy it again, we need to be open to a whole new world.
Done.
Joey, welcome back.
Welcome back.
I feel like we just flew into Fern Gully and saved a tree or five. Just gotta run with it. I'm keen to tell you to spin you a yarn.
Spin me a yarn.
Indeed. So
I'll be the kitten swatting at it.
I'll make it a very bright spool. I've been watching a lot of Netflix lately, mm-hmm. as the weather's been changing.
And because you're a human being in America.
Yeah, true.
Or anywhere in the world, apparently.
Very true. Very true. And someone recommended to me Elite, which is this steamy, soapy teen soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so good. It is so, so good. I have watched it religiously. I've recommended it to everybody I know.
The name Elite, I was assuming, was going to be like some like strike force or something like that.
A soap opera with teens or for teens or both?
You know what, Jess? I think that you literally just highlighted what's stirring in my soul right now. The question that I have, which is, why are teen soap operas so addictive? Ugh, Jess, you hit it. I think that you hit like the brain nugget that's like in my mind.
In your mind grapes.
In my mind grapes.
Let's make some wine.
We were talking mind wine yesterday.
All about that mind wine. It's totally unclear when I'm watching these shows as not a teenager, newsflash, whether or not this was really intended for me as this person who has the knowledge of what teenage years were actually like,
uh-huh.
to look back with both like horror and empathy, or if it's actually for current teenagers to make them feel more comfortable about how crazy life actually is. But regardless, I'm watching the shit out of these shows.
Yeah.
There's so many of them.
What is this show in particular about? Because I don't know how familiar I am even with the teen soap genre, because maybe I'm not defining it clearly.
Ooh, this is very good. So let's start actually by defining a teen soap opera. A teen soap is not a Days of Our Lives situation. It's the more culturally broken down
I need my
shows.
Stories.
It is the stories, the stories, the coming of age stories of teenagers, most likely set in and around a high school.
Mm.
Goes in and out of there. And they've been around for a long time. You see them on like CBS in more of a sitcom format in the 70s, but you didn't start seeing it until a little bit in the mid 80s and then blowing up in the 90s
mm-hmm.
as like its own genre. So you've got 90210, My So-Called Life, Dawson's Creek, of course.
Degrassi.
Degrassi. Ugh. Marco, you'll make it, Marco. And I guess Drake was on that same season. But
thanks, Degrassi.
Yeah. But these shows are always pretty much rooted around a, you know, a slice of life moment mm-hmm. about teenagers going through the transition from child to adult
mm-hmm.
and all of the emotional and crazy trappings that come with it. What makes Elite amazing is that it is so hyperbolic. It is about three outsiders who get a scholarship to a crazy rich prep school, and they all go to it. But then I can't even give anything away beyond that description. Let's just say that there's murder, there's mayhem, there is tons of sex, tons.
There's so much sex.
I was trying to watch it at my barbershop, and I was like, no, I need to turn this off. This is a little too steamy for the daytime. But it's incredibly good, and it's so addictive. It makes you want to watch every single episode. But this genre is really popular right now, and Netflix has been really capitalizing it mm-hmm. on it over the past couple of years.
Well, I'm curious, like, what is the distinction between a teen soap opera versus any other? Is it... purely just that it's about that particular slice of life? Because I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I'm, you know, drama is addictive as we can, you know, attest to with everything that, you know, becomes popular now is in some way dramatic, and true. TNT knows drama.
Oh,
but I'm curious, like, you know, I was trying to think of like what things based on what you were listing have I watched in some capacity at different points. I was like, is Gilmore Girls a teen soap?
Yes.
Is, I mean, the OC definitely is a teen soap. And I'm like, those are just, you know, or what was the
Gossip Girl? Coco.
XOXO.
There it is.
No, what was the movie Cruel Intentions?
Oh my God.
I mean, it wasn't a soap because it wasn't a serial, but that definitely feels like, and in this case, like, is it just that it's dramatic is what's enticing, and is the distinction, you know, like you would be interested in one of these shows if it was about being in your 20s, if it happened to just be good and dramatic, right?
I don't know. And this is one of the things, like, you've got so many other shows that are really about, like, you know, 30 somethings. How many shows have there been on network shows that have been about like 8 friends that live in an apartment in Chicago?
I believe it was called Friends.
Oh God.
30 something.
There was 30 something. Yeah. The New Girl. So there are some of these shows that do that, but usually they're sitcoms, and mm-hmm. occasionally they're not. This Is Us, for example. Mm-hmm. Heavy.
Parenthood.
Oh wow, just make me cry. Yeah. But I think with the teen dramas, it is about, I think what makes them special and what has made them stick is that it is about the, like, a moment when hyperbole is acceptable. So one of the things that defines teen soap operas to me is that there is this this heft to everything.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, it's the slow motion, somebody's walking down the hall moment, the super saturated colors of Riverdale and all of those types of shows.
Like the earnestness, is it about sort of capturing like how everything when you're a teenager feels like it's life and death? Like,
Parents
don't let you use the car or go to some place where your friends are going to be, and your whole world collapses because of FOMO.
Yeah.
Because you don't have that many experiences to go. Is it just about like capturing that, like, that you use the word heft, like that earnestness of everything is so important?
Everything is the first time, yeah. right? Like, I mean, with little babies, they talk about it a lot. It's like when you bump your elbow and you're crying like crazy. It's because you've never felt pain like that before. That happens again in the teenage years. That's when you start getting your heart, you know, bruised, and you start experiencing all sorts of funny things. But I think specifically from like an addiction perspective from a viewer, that translates really well to TV and film, to like those visual media forms. Yeah.
What's interesting about all of these shows that you're talking about, where you're saying, why is it so compelling to me, is that none of those shows are actually written by teenagers.
None.
They're written by adults who are reflecting back on their teenage experience with a deeper texture and an ability to articulate their motivations or their perceptions in those situations. So it's really teenagers interacting in situations like adults would,
yes,
but around teenage context, if that makes sense.
There's something really interesting about the show Skins when it initially launched.
Oh, I loved Skins. Did watch Skins.
Skins. Cook. The characters
You're
are
Scottish?
In
Scottish?
Yeah. Well, Cook,
it took place in London.
But Cook was Scottish or Welsh? I don't know. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah.
But that was written by a father-son team. One who was a teenager and then the father who was older, ostensibly.
Yeah.
And so... And
he had to be at least 9.
Yeah, yeah. And so that, like, the show was so special because it was this teen soap, but it was so much more raw, unabashed, and heavy-handed in the themes that it took on board.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think does make it work for, makes it and shows like it work for teenagers is this lack of understanding that the world has around how intense the world of a teenager actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today it's much worse, partially because of social media and the ability to be connected to everybody else in an unmediated way.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have, you know, people who are older who can say, like, you don't have to worry about that. Or here's a way to handle that. You're just getting embroiled in these really scary experiences that are extremely real.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about this through the lens of empathy and the idea of helping someone feel seen or heard. You know, when we watch these shows as adults, there's a little bit of tongue in cheek of like, it wasn't that serious. You know, like you can look back at your own high school life and be like, yeah, that was stupid, but it really wasn't the end of the world or whatever. But I think these shows sort of look at teen situations or teen interactions or their relationships with each other and as part of the drama make it feel to someone watching it that it's as important as it feels to them in real life, even if it's not actually, right? Like by the time you get out of your teenage years, you can look back and say like, all right, it was, you know, it wasn't great, but it was fine. But when you're in that moment, it feels really real, and these shows make it feel like it's real.
Yet part of me also thinks to not just teens and the teen experience, but also at least the American experience right now. I can speak for the American experience, maybe. But part of me makes me wonder, have we just built up a dramatic immunity of some kind, right?
Yeah.
And so we're not only seeking out these moments for empathy with our past or trying to connect with teenagers in this very specific example, but I think across the board we've sort of tended towards seeking out more concentrated doses of drama everywhere, right? It's not just with this one space.
I totally agree. It's part of this greater entertainment industrial complex. A lot of anthropologists will point to compassion fatigue as an experience that people go through. A lot of folks who are watching horrible events happening in the news, and when those events are constantly inundating viewers who weren't there, they build up an essential resistance to horrible things. And this has been talked about since Vietnam. Like since the Vietnam War was televised in the States, this became a huge conversation about how do we keep people engaged with reality while still informing them. And the fact that entertainment and news have become completely synonymous in so many places, we have built up this greater resistance and need those bigger hits of like, I need the needle to spike.
So you're saying we're normalizing drama?
Absolutely. I think that we've found drama to be, I think that we need greater amounts and more shocking forms of drama to feel it. So much of it drama. I thought you were going to go Mary J, but you went in a different direction, which I appreciate.
I went Fergie.
Straight Fergie. But yeah, I think that there's also like that sort of hyperbole is one of the things, like going back to those like mm-hmm. ridiculous lines, the heavy handed imagery, the slow motion shots, like it's all so over the top, and Riverdale has spiked because of it.
No, I want to push back on just one part of that.
Don't push back on me, Joseph. Don't you dare.
I agree on like the fatigue points and normalizing points, but I do think there's something like when you're in sort of a dramatic situation in your own life, it feels like that, yeah. right? Like in yeah. that moment when you're like deeply fighting with your partner mm-hmm. or like you don't know how to like work around some obstacle, it feels massive. And sometimes I think, you know, if you're watching a show, it wouldn't do justice to the emotions that you feel when you're in that situation if it wasn't exaggerated. I think there's the line, right? There's that like jump the shark line somewhere in there where you're saying, you know, it needs to be more dramatic, or no, we're not capturing. And then all of a sudden it's just like, no, that's not realistic. Mm-hmm. There is sort of this like uncanny valley point mm-hmm. that you fall into where it just gets too dramatic.
Well, I think there is something to the reflection of an empathetic reflection of real life experience. Mm-hmm. So reflecting, using drama as a way to sort of show this is what you would feel like if you were going through it. So let's make it bigger. Yeah. Right. But then there's also this sort of like, I think one of the other things that makes it so addictive is not just that it's big, but that they use so many taboos. So mm-hmm. there are things that are going on in some of these teen soaps that, you know, as an old man, I'm just kind of like, you know, kids aren't doing that these days. Are yeah. you kidding? You're not getting up to those shenanigans. What are you doing?
Gallivanting about.
Yes. But at the exact same time, I think about my parents probably have saying the same thing about like me watching Dawson's Creek and seeing Pacey hooking up with his teacher. Mary Kay Letourneau's on TV doing it. Like yeah. these things are happening, and having this sort of space to creatively explore taboos, I think also requires that hyperbole. It requires it to be a little bit more shocking, a little bit more big, to allow for some of the investigation of some of these themes. And I think it does strike a little bit of like, is the world changing faster than I realize?
But I think to your point about that tackling those things, you still want to have a foot in reality for the successful versions of these shows that you're talking about, right? Like by the end of season one, even, and certainly but well before the show was finished, like the OC jumped the shark. It True. Got too dramatic. It wasn't realistic. Gossip Girl did the same thing. Those first seasons felt like they were sort of had a foot in reality and they were just dramatizing reality. And then at some point, you know, people are getting into like money laundering scandals mm-hmm. and whatever, like while going to like high school chemistry class mm-hmm. or whatever was happening on Gossip Girl. I've seen it sort of in the background. I don't fully know what the storylines
are. Let's go to Butter.
Yeah. But I think the... I think the ones that have done it well are sort of dramatizing one foot in reality. Like even Gilmore Girls has this sort of cultural resurgence because it wasn't like so over the top, but it was still dramatic. There is sort of that happy line you want to hit.
Yeah. I mean, I can't have a conversation about soapy teen dramas without talking about Teen Wolf. So,
Teen Wolf? Ooh.
And not the Michael J. Fox, the MTV one. Because I think your point about reflecting reality is challenged a little bit by Vampire Diaries, Teen Wolf. And then in film, you get things like Mark and Jacob.
Twilight.
Thank yeah. you. Good
Not
God.
Mark. Not Mark. Edward.
Edward. Oh.
But in those stories, Remember there's, the lore. Still, there's still something that feels like it reflects a real thing about humanity, even if it's about
True.
Right, like
no, I'll give you that.
It gets to something at the heart of relationships, or of like growing up, or you know,
or being something different and finding your tribe.
Yeah,
which is what Teen Wolf is all
or
about.
Or having a jump watch. Off.
Yeah.
Wait, is that like a competition of jumping?
No,
I think
you
though,
can look it up.
Okay.
We will save this last dance. Yes, we will.
All right. Well, what we've learned today is that it's okay to be dramatic.
Yeah. Yo, let your freak flag fly, y'all. Just do that.
And apparently also watch Elite on Netflix.
Friday nights at 9 or whenever you turn on your TV.
We'll be getting the check in the mail. Thank you, Netflix, for this promotion.
Yeah, you guys are great. Yeah. See you guys next time.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in MacGyver Studios in beautiful New York, New York.
We'd like to thank executive producer and spice aficionado, Jess Vander.
We'd also like to thank sound engineer and all-around good fella, Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for our beautiful cover art.
And all of the production help that we've received from Sara Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Vong.
And also, as always, thanks, Alin. We also want to give special thanks to Teen Wolves with no shirts on.
Specifically Colton Haynes. We'd also like to thank Greg Berlanti for creating Dawson's Creek, Riverdale, and everything else in between.
We'd also like to thank the Gilmore Girls for Gilmorin.
We'd like to... We'd like to thank Higgs and Boson for finding new particles for us to look at.
We'd like to thank the Observer Principal for collapsing reality into Gossip Girls.
We'd like to thank Butter Restaurant. We're still there, Butter. We're still with you.
Butter, be listening next week.
Bye.
Joey, this is profane.
Yeah, that's why I said you can look it up later.